food safety, internet freedom, shipping rates, work rules, exemptions from patent restrictions, sharing of technology. These are just a few of the issues seemingly resolved during nearly 8 years of negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. The agreement between the U.S. and 11 Pacific Rim countries is the largest regional trade accord in history. And now that this version has been worked out this week, it will come under greater debate and scrutiny in each of the respective 12 nations and in Congress. But will nations ever see exactly how the deal, shrouded in secrecy, was really negotiated? Ambassador Ron Kirk was the U.S. trade representative from 2009 to 2013 and the president's top trade official at that time. He joins me now. Welcome.
John, thanks so much for having me.
A long journey comes to an end or comes to a beginning?
Well, you know, it both. It's the beginning now of the public understanding the value proposition and the rationale for why this deal is so important and why it makes sense. And so, and for many Americans that have become increasingly skeptical about the value proposition of trade agreements, the simplest way that I can explain it is just that we as Americans have to both embrace and exploit the opportunity that's inherent in one important fact. 95% of the world's consumers now live somewhere other than the United States. And notwithstanding all the blather you hear about our economy, we are still the best house on a bad block economically. We're the strongest economy in the world. But for our continued prosperity, it is in each and every one of our own selfish economic interests, either as consumers or as farmers or workers or entrepreneurs, to make sure we have access to all these new consumers. And this Trans-Pacific Partnership is going to give us access to ultimately maybe 1.5 billion consumers if you combine it with the agreement with Europe. It puts us in the middle of the largest new economic zone in the world. Our farmers, ranchers, businesses, entrepreneurs will be able to now sell into that market with more protections and duty-free, and go in and compete for all these new consumers that are now beginning to have dollars to spend and have envied the lifestyle we've enjoyed in this country for the last century, and they want a piece of that pie. And whatever else you think about trade, as counterintuitive as it is, the United States is now better positioned than any other country in the world to provide the services, the food, the technology, the skills that other countries need to move from less developed stages to more urban settings, more developed.
So this gives us access to markets in food, and it is largely agricultural, I think, although there are many other industries that would potentially benefit here. But in return for that, don't those nations in Asia get a lot of latitude as far as intellectual property, as far as taking products and refashioning them in their own sort of branding and not paying
absolutely.
The U.S. for that?
Quite the contrary. One of the biggest objectives that we have as Americans, we have a knowledge-based economy now. You know, and whether we like it or not, the sort of first generation, you know, textile manufacturing has moved on. It always moves to countries that are moving out of poverty and gotten millions of workers, whether it's, you know, from Latin America to China or now Vietnam. We have a knowledge-based economy that is very much dependent on our being able to not only protect the genius of our work product, but also be able to make sure that we can have the market benefits of that when it goes. And so one of our goals is to seek stronger intellectual property rights for both patents and copyrights and trademarks. And it prevents those countries from taking our products and pirating and copying them. And that is one of the real initiatives that we've undertaken during the Obama administration, is to combat the theft of American genius, whether it's through copyright or pirating. And that's one of the real strengths of this Trans-Pacific Partnership deal. We've got a lot of countries that heretofore really had no intellectual property rights regime at all. And at least now we're going to have a baseline of protection. So, John, that's one area that, on the contrary, this is one of the strengths of this deal.
Why not more transparency in the negotiation of the particular deals, particularly the work rules in Malaysia and Southeast Asia, where there's a lot of concern that Vietnam and Malaysia and Thailand won't really sign on to ultimately to the work rule requirements and environmental regulations.
They did. Again, I mean, I hear, you know, transparency is in the eye of the beholder. And so, you know, people say this isn't transparent. I can't speak for any other country. But in the case of the United States, our trade policy is the most regulated, observed, subject to interagency discipline, subject to public input than any other. Both of our congressional committees of jurisdiction sort of come together and pre-clear everything we want to achieve. We have 16 congressionally mandated trade advisory committees, including one on labor. And these are all cleared advisors that have access to everything we're trying to achieve. Now, understand, in a negotiation like this, you have the most developed economies in the world, like the United States or Australia or Singapore, and you've got countries that are trying to make that step, like Vietnam and Malaysia. We can't go in and fully impose our labor regime on them, but what we can do is say, look, there are some baseline labor rights that many of us have signed on through the International Labor Organization. At least says, look, let's not trade in goods that are made with slave labor or child labor. And let's at least recognize all workers ought to have the right to collectively bargain and organize. And so those baseline agreements are included in this Trans-Pacific Partnership in the labor chapter, and they are enforceable, which in many trade agreements in the past have not been. So much of the criticism that John, you sort of reflexively hear anytime people bring up a trade agreement, I think once people read the agreement, understand what it does, much of that criticism, I think, will be dissolved.
Well, you're selling the agreement, certainly, and that's certainly what you were doing.
Well, I'm trying to give you the facts. My intent's not to sell the agreement. But
will it get through Congress? Will Congress object?
You know, what I've always said to both trade opponents and to our partners who use that skepticism, oh, you'll never get through this in Congress, is that there's never the right time to take a bad deal to the American public. But if we can get a deal that's fair, that opens markets for American exporters, that has labor and environmental protections and intellectual property, the other things that you ticked off, and it really gives Americans a level playing field when it comes to competing in your market, we can always sell that to Congress. It's going to be a tough sell, but I believe this is too big of an opportunity for the United States to pass on.
Ambassador Ron Kirk, former United States Trade Representative from 2009 to 2013 and former mayor of Dallas, Texas. Thanks so much.
John, it's an honor to be with you. Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.